So my goal for the talk today is going to be to give a combinatorial, or more specifically, cluster algebraic description of a certain Hopf algebra, namely the quantum group UQ of S1+1, from what you might loosely call the quantum topology of surfaces. Okay, so that's where we're going to be heading. And I think I want to kind of start out by kind of orienting ourselves and saying a few words about the algebraic side of the story. So namely, the kinds of quantum groups that we'll be talking about. So the main player for us is going to be this fellow UQSLn+1, quantized enveloping algebra of the simple Lie algebra SLn+1. And what is this guy? Well, it's first of all a Hopf algebra. So it's a Hopf algebra. And as a Hopf algebra, you can kind of regard it as being a deformation of the enveloping algebra U of SLn+1, so just the enveloping algebra of the Lie algebra SLn+1. So how can we think about this Hopf algebra UQ SLn+1? Is it okay if I kind of, like, what point should I stop writing on these boards? All the way to the bottom? Great. So how to think about this Hopf algebra UQ SLn+1? So the way that I want to describe it to you to begin with is the most algebraic way possible, so by generators and relations.
Yeah.
Okay. So.
I think it'll get uncomfortable with that.
That's probably right. So it has generators x1 plus and minus up to xn plus and minus, and generators k1 up to kn. And these generators satisfy some relations. Let me just write a subset of those relations to give you a flavor of how they look. So there's some relations describing how the kind of positive part of the algebra interacts with the negative part of the algebra. And the commutator of an xi plus with an xj minus is going to be 0 if I and j are different. And if they're the same, it's going to be given by q minus q inverse times ki minus ki inverse. OK. Then there's also some relations describing how the k's interact with the x plus and minuses. So ki times xk plus or minus is equal to q to some number aij times xk plus or minus times k I, where aij is equal to 2 if I and j coincide, and minus 1 if they differ by 1. So it's the Cartan matrix of SLn+1. And the last kind of relations that I'm not going to write out and inflict upon you are some cubic relations called the Q Serre relations, which are Q deformations of the Serre relations defining the in the yeah.
Huh?
I want to have it in the numerator. I want to think about this algebra. So really, I'm going to be working over something like rational functions in Q, so it doesn't make a huge difference. But how I want you to think of this UQ SLn+1 is as a deformation of a commutative algebra. I want you to think about it as quantized algebra of functions on the Poisson-Lie dual group to the group with the standard structure. So, yeah.
Sorry.
But that's a very good question. It's more conventional to put it in the denominator and to think about uq of s1 plus 1 really being a deformation of something non-commutative.
So your xi is like q minus q number squared of my xi.
Just q, well, I want to sort of treat them symmetrically, so probably q minus q inverse times.
Okay.
Yeah. But yeah.
Aij is plus or minus.
Say again? Ah, yeah, thanks. Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. So that's completely algebraic description of sort of one half of the Hopf algebra structure, namely the algebra structure of U q s1 plus 1. But really, that's sort of not what makes it so very different from ordinary U of s1 plus 1. Really, the interesting part of the deformation is the co-algebra structure. Okay, so how does the co-product look? Well, remember, the co-product is a map from U q of s1 plus 1 to its tensor square. So again, I'm going to tell you the value of the coproduct on the generators. So the coproduct of xi plus is given by xi plus tensor 1 plus, which looks pretty familiar from the case of the enveloping algebra, where this guy just be honestly primitive. But now we see something a little bit unusual, which is ki tensor xi plus. And similarly, xi minus is given by delta of xi minus is xi minus tensor ki inverse plus 1 tensor xi. And lastly, these elements ki are group-like elements of the Hopf algebra. So the coproduct is of ki is ki tensor ki. So the most immediate thing you notice about this definition of the coproduct is that it's not co-commutative. Okay, so in other words, if I look at the opposite coproduct, delta op, which by definition is just what I get if I do my original coproduct followed by a flip of tensor factors, this guy here is not equal to the original coproduct. Okay, so this is sort of the main difference between uq of s1 plus 1 and its kind of undeformed analog u of s1 plus 1. So we lose co-commutativity, but we pick up something that's kind of much more interesting, perhaps. And what is that? Well, uq of sln plus 1 turns out to be what is called a quasi-triangular Hopf algebra. OK, so what does quasi-triangular mean? Well, basically what it boils down to is that there's a special element called the universal R matrix. So this element R lives in the tensor square of uq s1 plus 1. And this element R has the property, well, among other things, that my opposite coproduct is related to my original coproduct by conjugation by the R matrix. Okay, so this R matrix conjugates you between the original coproduct and the opposite one. And moreover, this R matrix satisfies the Young-Baxter equation in the tensor cube of UQG. So it's, in other words, it satisfies this kind of braiding relation R1, 2, R1, 3, R2, 3, where the indices on the R matrices indicate which tensor factors they're living in. So this triple product is equal to the one taken in the opposite order, like that. Okay. So the upshot of the existence of such an R matrix is that the category of representations of UQ SLN plus 1 is still a braided tensor category. So if I have two representations V and W, I have an isomorphism of UQ SLN plus 1 representations with W tensor V given by action of the R matrix followed by flip of the tensor factors. So despite losing commutativity, which means we can't just flip the tensor factors and have a nice morphism, we have this element R, which still makes everything work out. OK, so let me briefly describe what this R matrix is. Sort of one way to think about it, which was worked out by Kirillov and Reshetykin. So how to kind of explicitly describe this R matrix. So in order to do it, we need to fix a normal ordering on the set of simple roots which I'll call delta plus of SLn plus 1. Okay, so we fix some normal ordering there. Then it turns out that having chosen that data, there exists what are called some special elements in UQ of SLn plus 1 called quantum root vectors. Okay, so these guys, quantum root vectors x alpha plus or minus, where alpha runs over the set of, sorry, I don't know why I wrote it simply. Should have said positive roots. Okay, so I fix a normal ordering on the set of positive roots. I then have a collection of quantum root vectors x alpha plus and minus for each alpha a positive root. And the R matrix can then be expressed as some prefactor in these elements ki times a product taken consistent with our choice of normal ordering over the set of positive roots of some function phi q evaluated on x alpha plus tensor x alpha minus. So what is this function phi q? This function phi q of x is a special function called the quantum dilogarithm function. And it's given by a formal power series, given by this infinite product formula like this. So this guy here is called quantum dilogarithm. OK, so this R matrix is not something terribly mysterious. It's given by some nice kind of explicitly theoretic formula depending on quantum root vectors in the quantum group. OK? So I think that's all the sort of purely algebraic things I want to say about UQ of SLn plus 1. So now I want to kind of switch gears a little bit and try and describe each of these features we talked about in some geometric or sort of topological terms. OK, so yeah, any questions about the sort of algebraic setup before I change tack a little bit? OK, so now let's talk about character varieties. And kind of following the work of Fock and Goncharov. OK, so the kind of topological setting that we are going to be working in is that of marked surfaces. So it's going to be kind of the basic underlying topological object. So what is it? So a marked surface, which we'll write as S hat, is a compact oriented surface S, sort of the underlying surface, together with a finite set of special points, so sort of marked points, x1 through xk, lying on the boundary of S. Okay, so a finite set of boundary marked points. OK, so given one of these marked surfaces, we can define what's called its punctured boundary so the punctured boundary of S hat, which we'll write as del S hat, is just the set that you get by taking the boundary of S and deleting out these mark points. Okay? So if we had some compact oriented surface, its boundary is just going to be a union of circles and intervals. And so when we delete out these mark points, this punctured boundary is just going to be, again, some union of circle components and interval components. OK. So what kind of topological gadgets are we going to want to associate to these marked surfaces? So what we're going to want to do is study various kinds of local systems and kind of framed local systems. So let me kind of describe particular details of the moduli spaces that were considered by Fock and Gongshorov and that we're going to use to realize the quantum groups geometrically. So let's kind of start just by fixing for once and for all G to be the group PGLN plus 1 over the complex numbers. And now let's just recall that if we want to think about G local systems on a surface S, well, these guys are in correspondence with group homomorphisms from the fundamental group of the surface to the group G. And if what I really care about is isomorphism classes of G local systems on my surface, then that equivalence relation of isomorphism of local systems is reflected in the action of the group G on the set of such homomorphisms by conjugation on the target. Okay. So this is how I want to think about local systems, sort of Betti point of view. And what we're going to want to do in order to get something that will be related to the quantum groups is to look at some kind of additional data, some kind of framing data. So let's also fix B inside of G to be a Borel subgroup, which you're quite free to think about as the subgroup of upper triangular matrices. So that this space Q mod B is going to be the flag variety, which again, you can feel free to think of as a variety of complete flags in the vector space Cn plus 1. So having kind of fixed that data, given a local system L, what can I produce from it? Well, I can produce this sort of associated flag bundle by taking the quotient of the product of the local system L with G mod B by the diagonal action of G. So this is sort of associated flag bundle built from the local system. And it's this fellow that's going to be important for saying what it means to give some framing data for the local system. So so let me get to the sort of proper definition of that framing data. So a framed G-local system on the marked surface S hat is the following data. So first of all, it's a G local system L on the underlying topological surface S. And the extra framing data that we're going to assign is a flat section of the restriction to the punctured boundary of the associated flag bundle to that local system. Okay, so that's what a frame local system is. So we can kind of unpack what that framing data means very concretely in the following way. So what does it mean? So we've taken this associated flag bundle, restricted it to the punctured boundary. So remember, this punctured boundary was just a union of S1 components and interval components. So what this data is so for each interval component, so each contractible component of the punctured boundary, the data of a flat section is just a flag in the flag variety. And for each circle component, let's call this component gamma. We want our framing data is going to be a flag F fixed by monodromy around gamma. Okay, so it needs to be a flat section of the restriction of the flag bundle to the punctured boundary. So that's in very concrete terms what this additional framing data is attacking compared to just a plain local system. Okay, and then so then maybe with the definition here. So the kind of main player for Falkin, Goncharov, and for us in this talk is this variety X key S hat, which by definition is moduli of framed key local systems on the marked surface S hat. Okay. So let's kind of look at a few examples of the definition to see what kind of things these varieties X, key S hat can look like. Okay. Okay, so as a first example, let's think about the case where S hat is just a disk together with three special marked points on the boundary. Okay? So what is the data of a frame local system on this S hat? Well, in this example, the underlying topological surface is just contractible, right? It's just a disk. So there's the underlying local system is always just going to be trivial. So the only data that's left is the framing. And what is our framing data going to be here? Well, our punctured boundary is just the union of three intervals, right? And so by the definition, we're supposed to have for each one of these interval components of punctured boundary between two consecutive crosses, we're supposed to have a flag, F1, F2, and F3. So in this case here, our moduli space is going to be the quotient of three copies of key mod B by the action, the diagonal action of key, which maybe I should have drawn on the other side, but I think you know what I mean. Okay? So this you can think of as like configuration space of three points in key mod B. Okay? So that's one example. Let's look at maybe a more interesting one. So let's suppose we take our marked surface to be now an annulus, and our kind of marking data to be two points on one of the boundary components. So what data do we have here? So now we actually have a non-trivial monodromy, right? Because our annulus is low contractible. So we have some blue loop gamma and some monodromy key gamma around there. Now what about, that's sort of going to be describing our local system. So what about our framing data? Well, what is our punctured boundary now? So on this outer piece of the boundary, I have two interval components again. So I'm going to have two more flags, F1, F2. And now, you see, I have this circle component of punctured boundary, unlike in the previous case. So I have a third flag, F3, associated to the circle component. And now what is the data of my space X, P, S hat? So now it's going to consist of F1. So first of all, let's put our G gamma, and then our F1, F2, F3. And now for the flag F3 associated to the circle component of boundary, we have this condition that it has to be preserved by the monodromy around that that cycle. So we need that key gamma F3 is equal to F3, and we need to mod out all of this data by the diagonal action of key. Okay, so that's what the moduli space looks like in this case of an annulus with two mark points on one boundary component and no mark point on the other one. So for the kind of aficionados of the geometric representation theory, you'll notice that this guy is sort of very closely related to this Grothendieck Springer resolution key tilde maps to G. And what is this key tilde? It's the variety of pairs consisting of a group element and a flag such that the group element preserves the flag. So this guy is some sort of very close cousin of this Grothendieck Springer resolution that plays sort of big role in the geometric representation theory. Okay, so questions about the definition of the moduli spaces or any of the examples? Great. Okay, so let's quickly run through some properties of these moduli spaces. X key is hat. Okay, and again, these properties were mostly worked out by Fokin and Gonchurov. So the first nice thing is that the X, G, S hat are rational varieties that come with a Poisson bracket, which write it as the usual kind of curly bracket notation. So it's mapped from the tensor square of the structure sheaf to itself. And what's more, the kind of really neat thing about these varieties is that they're what's called cluster Poisson varieties. Okay, so I think I want to spend a few minutes kind of spelling out exactly what I mean by saying something's a cluster Poisson variety. So Oops. So what exactly does that mean? Okay, so it means that the variety x key s hat is covered up to a locus of codimension 2 by an atlas of toric charts. Let's write them sort of T subscript sigma. It's going to be a map from the algebraic torus of appropriate dimension to our variety x key s hat. And these toric charts are labeled by quivers. So if I have my chart T sigma, I'll have a quiver Q sigma. And these quivers will be kind of indexing the charts in this atlas on the variety. And so what is kind of the role the quiver is playing in the description of the chart? Well, what it's doing is encoding the Poisson structure on the variety. So to be more precise about that, let's write epsilon jk to be this kind of adjacency matrix, signed adjacency matrix of the quiver. Okay, so we'll take the number of arrows pointing from vertex j to vertex k in one of my quivers minus the number of arrows going from k to j. And I'll form some skew symmetric matrix epsilon jk. Then the coordinate functions x1 through xd on one of these toric charts satisfy the following nice Poisson bracket relations. So if I take the Poisson bracket of the jth one of these coordinates with the kth one, the result is proportional to just the product of epsilon j and epsilon k. And the coefficient of proportionality is this signed adjacency matrix of the quiver, epsilon jk. Okay, so this is how the quiver encodes the Poisson structure on the variety. And the other kind of where to move to? Maybe I'll kind of move it here. So I might want to keep those pictures around for later on. So just to reiterate, we have this family of toric charts on our variety, indexed by quivers. And moreover, the different quivers labeling different toric charts are related by a combinatorial rule called mutation. So they're related by a sequence of combinatorial moves called mutations. So what are these mutations? Well, if I have some vertex k in q sigma, then I can do an operation called mutation at vertex k, so mu k, that will produce me a new quiver q mu k sigma. Okay, and how does this combinatorial operation work? Let me, instead of sort of giving you the gory details of the definition, just kind of describe it on an example. Okay, so imagine we have a quiver looks something like this. Draw the arrows in, maybe in color. Oops. I guess that's vertex has gotten a little bit erased. And that's not supposed to be a double arrow, that's just a sure being silly. Okay, so suppose you have some quiver like this, and our vertex k, say, is going to be this middle guy in here. And what does it mean to produce a new quiver by mutating at vertex k? So the new quiver has the same underlying vertices as the old quiver did. So let's just draw those right back in. And then we form the mutated guy in a series of three steps. So the first step is that I look at all paths of length 2 that pass through my vertex k. So for instance, this one going up like that, and this one going down like that, these guys coming around like this. And for each one of those paths, I create a little kind of shortcut in that going sort of a new length 1 path going where the old one went. So I'll have a shortcut going like this, shortcutting this path, a shortcut going like this, shortcutting the old path. And then I'll have 2 shortcuts coming down like this, and one coming up like that. And so that's step one. I make all these shortcuts for all these length 2 paths passing through the vertex I'm mutating at. Step 2 is that I reverse the orientation of all the arrows incident to the vertex I'm mutating at. So I'm going to have some arrows that go like in, out. And then the final step is that I cancel any length 2 oriented cycles that I produced by doing all of these moves, right? So you see that I still have these edges like this from my old quiver, but now I've made these, when I added these shortcuts here and here, I made some length 2 oriented cycles. So in the final step, I just cancel off those length 2 oriented cycles, and I get left with a quiver that looks like this. Okay, so that's the sort of combinatorial rule of what it means to mutate a quiver at a particular vertex. So what I need to tell you now is what happens to our toric coordinate functions. Okay, so I am going to produce some new coordinate functions on my new chart that are going to be given by the following nice subtraction-free rational functions in my old toric coordinates. So the way it works is that if k is equal to k, I just invert my old coordinates, my old coordinate. And otherwise, you get a new coordinate that looks like xk times 1 plus xk to the sine of epsilon kj raised to the power of epsilon kj. Okay, so that's how my new coordinates look on my mutated coordinate chart. And this might look like a kind of arbitrary thing to do, but it turns out to have a really remarkable property, which is that it's compatible with the Poisson structure. In other words, if I calculate the Poisson brackets of x j prime with x k prime, then it's again going to be equal to epsilon prime. Now, epsilon prime being the adjacency matrix of my new mutated quiver, jk times x j prime times x k prime. So the remarkable thing is that this mutation rule allows you to kind of compatibly glue together all of these sort of Poisson tori in order to get a well-defined global Poisson structure on the whole variety. Okay. Yeah.
So you mentioned that this chart might be a circular dimensional rule.
Absolutely, yeah.
Is this typical?
It's very typical, yeah.
Have you said about this locus?
So
this kata.
Yeah. I mean it's certainly very typical in these examples, basically related to the sort of Lie theoretical examples that involve covering these varieties by charts basically coming from sort of factorizations in the group. I don't know if I have an intelligent sort of general characterization of the locus missed by the charts. But yeah, it's a good question.
Could be mistaken, I could be confusing Xenia varieties. Uh-huh. There's some statement where, like, he missed the locus in the analytic topology, but he hit it in his wrist.
Interesting.
But I don't want to say anything specific.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Maybe if you give us some examples later, you might include an example of something that's...
Well, yeah. I mean, like the trivial local system is always going to get missed. there's just no way you can. It's just too singular of a thing to ever be in a rational variety.
Mass surfaces, like on a piece with map points.
Yeah, yeah.
Still might miss.
I think you'll still miss things in there. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, even in like a double Brewer cell, the cluster charts will only kind of cover it up to a conformation two locus, I think. It's like the nicest possible example.
But it's something about missing a pretty single
place. Well, I think there's kind of two kinds of things you can miss. But I think it's missing related to things being too singular to ever be in a rational variety, which like the trivial local system. And it's also missing kind of related to like Lie theoretic problems in terms of factorization coordinates on Brewer cells. But maybe I'm mistaken.
I think for fancy groups, not UN.
So I think it's probably a problem even for UN. Oh, well, I mean, okay. For SL, I mean, like all this stuff is sort of, good question. Okay. Right. So, I sort of asserted to you that these moduli spaces X, Q, S hat are really cluster Poisson varieties. So in order to kind of convince you of that assertion, I should exhibit for you a sort of atlas of charts on these varieties that satisfy these properties. So let me kind of explain to you how that works. Sort of combinatorics of how that works. So cluster combinatorics for X, Q, S hat. So how does this work? Well, this X, Q, S hat has a family of toric charts indexed by what's called ideal triangulations. Of S hat. Okay, so what do I mean by an ideal triangulation? The way to think about these guys is that we picture the circle components of the puncture boundary as sort of punctures or kind of cusps. Okay? And then an ideal triangulation is one where the vertices are at either the marked points or these, what we're visualizing as punctures. Okay, so.
The same set, right? You just gave us. You're not saying there's some mark points in some other punctures.
Sure. So let me draw some pictures, and I think it'll make it clear. I mean, the point is that they're not really triangulations, right? They're like sort of asymptotic triangulations or something.
Sorry, I missed the first part of
what you said. So, sort of example of what I mean by these triangulations. So imagine we have a disk with four mark points on the boundary. And I could say my edges of my triangulation have to start and end at these mark points. So I could have something like, you know, this would be a nice valid triangulation. I have, you know, triangle here and here. And another kind of example would be back to this example with the annulus. So now I'm going to think about this S1 component of the boundary as being kind of like pulled off to infinity and being like a cusp. And now I can triangulate. Let me exploit these colors a little bit to draw him triangulation like this. Okay, so now my triangles are like this, 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 and this, this, and this. So these are examples of what. Yeah. Oh. No. Yeah.
Sorry. It's the question of this black.
Yeah.
I think normally I would have thought of adding a condition like consecutive flags along the boundary.
That certainly should be said here in order to get, you know, a nice rational variety. I just glossed over saying
would that have eliminated this problem for dimension two?
It would have, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But at the level of global functions, which is kind of how most people like to think about cluster varieties, like the issue of removing the codimension two doesn't matter, but yeah. That's a good point. Okay.
Because we can take this spaces of flat. Want to be spaces of flat on that.
Yeah, that's right.
You have a lot of flat, and then you want.
Yeah. Uh-huh. That's right. Good. Okay. Right, so we've said that these varieties have a system of toric charts that are indexed by ideal triangulations. And so now what I need to tell you is how to take one of these ideal triangulations and produce a quiver, right? Where should I do that? Maybe over here. So, quiver from triangulation. So again, the recipe kind of goes in a bunch of steps. So the first step, so let me first tell you what to do for the kind of rank one case of PGL2, and then I'll explain how it generalizes to the higher rank. So, so for PGL2, we're going to inside every triangle draw kind of this elementary basic quiver. So how this quiver looks? Well, we have a vertex on every edge of the triangle, and what are the arrows in this quiver? We, using the orientation of the surface, draw like a counterclockwise cycle inside the triangle. So first thing we do is for each triangle, we draw this basic quiver inside. And then in the second step, we glue the vertices of the quiver, of the quivers, the basic ones, according to the triangulation. And again, cancel any length to cycles that we might have made when we did this gluing procedure. OK? So let's look at a couple of the triangulations we drew over here, maybe to illustrate how this business works. So what do we have to do? We have to put basic quivers inside the triangles, and then glue things up. According to the triangulation. So you see that we get a quiver like this when we look at the disk with four points on the boundary. What about our friend the annulus? Well, here we do the same kind of thing. I guess I used the wrong color for the edges of my triangulation. So let me switch. So now you see that something a little bit more interesting is going to happen. I drew that X the wrong way. So we orient our triangles counterclockwise, and we glue them up. But now you see when I did this gluing, I've made a length 2 cycle here, right? So I have to erase him, and we'll get this quiver, which looks like just an oriented 4 cycle. So we'll get a quiver that looks like that. Okay, so that's how the gluing of the quiver procedure works. So that's how it works in the rank 1 case. How does it work in the higher rank? So it's very similar in that we replace every triangle in the triangulation by a kind of a basic quiver, and then we glue them up. The only thing that changes is that the basic quiver gets kind of subdivided a little bit. So for PGL n plus 1 for higher rank, it's the same, but subdivide basic quiver. Subdivide. The basic quiver. So let me just kind of illustrate how it looks like for PGL3, and you'll be able to see what the pattern looks like. So I'll draw my triangle for my triangulation. So now in the, this rank 2 case of PGL3, I have 2 vertices of my quiver on every edge of my triangulation. And now I also have another vertex coming from this sort of subdivision in the interior of the triangle. And again, I orient everything according to the orientation of the surface. And there's just one final little kind of kink in the construction, which is what goes on with these between these vertices that are lying on the same side of the triangle. And it turns out that you have to put in kind of an arrow of weight 1/2 in between these guys here. It's a little bit weird, but that's the way it goes. So that's the basic quiver for PGL3. You can kind of imagine how the ones look in higher rank.
Can I just cancel like a little bit? I don't know what a weight 1/2 arrow is, but it's oppositely oriented.
But you don't have to glue things always in the same kind of, like you can imagine a gluing pattern where things can reinforce rather than cancel.
I can't,
you
said these were oriented surfaces.
Yeah, but I mean, imagine you have, think about kind of a fat graph that looks like this kind of something, right? Like gluing two pairs of triangles by, like this, then you're going to get edges on the outside that kind of like. Anyway, I mean, the point is that even in the case of just a single triangle, you need these weight 1/2 arrows in order to describe the Poisson structure between the variables there.
Do you really want to keep the nodes on the
panel? That's a good point. That comes down to the sort of question of whether we're working with, as Thea pointed out, the A variety or the X variety. So you can always kind of, you can keep them around and regard them as being kind of like coefficient variables or frozen variables.
But with this specific definition?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with this specific definition, you shouldn't keep them around.
You should not keep them around.
Yeah. If you really want, you should. I mean, really, these things are come from coordinates on this A variety, where you're looking at. So, your framing data is now a section of the restriction to the punctured boundary of a sort of principal flag local systems, but. Yeah, that's a good point. You do have to be a little bit careful about whether or not you regard these as actual coordinates on the modulus.
But it's still a fine Poisson variety.
It's still just a fine Poisson variety, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
Do these factors of 1/2 fit in Hubble?
Not that I mean, they're kind of, they're really what makes everything work as far as the quantization goes, I guess. But, Okay. So that's the combinatorics of a single chart. And then you'll kind of notice the neat thing, which is the following. So all of these ideal triangulations are related by flips of diagonal in a triangulation. Diagonal. So for instance, in this guy, we could have flipped his diagonal instead of this diagonal to be, you know, this diagonal. And as you'll notice in this SL2 example, we draw in what the quiver we get here. A little bit strange. Yeah, draw him down. So you'll see that the quivers in this SL2 case corresponding to a flip of diagonal are also the quivers that are related by performing a cluster mutation at this sort of central vertex. So at least in the SL2 example, it's clear that the flips of diagonal correspond to cluster mutation. And the kind of remarkable thing is that in the higher rank case, it's no longer true that doing a single cluster mutation will realize you a flip of diagonal, but you'll have to do a sequence of them, and you'll have to do sort of n plus 2 q's 3 many cluster mutations, but you'll still be able to realize your flip of diagonal by a sequence of cluster mutations. So it turns out that these family of charts corresponding to the ideal triangulations kind of glue together compatibly with the cluster combinatorics. OK? Great. So so that's all I want to say about the these varieties. Now I want to kind of quickly move on to their kind of canonical quantization. Maybe right down here. So just very quickly. So the idea here is really simple. It's just that we're going to promote our torus T sigma to a quantum torus algebra. Maybe we'll call it TQ sigma, which is generated again by these sort of quantum coordinate functions, x1 through xd. But now we promote our Poisson bracket to this kind of skew commutativity, Q commutativity commutation relation. Okay. So for each cluster in our cluster algebra, we have a quantum torus algebra. And it turns out that there's a notion of quantum mutation that describes how these different quantum torus algebras glue together. So at the level of quivers, it's exactly the same as before. But at the level of functions, we have an algebra homomorphism between one quantum torus algebra and the one corresponding to the mutated quiver. And the way that this quantum mutation works is it kind of decomposes into two pieces. So the first piece is some very simple monomial algebra homomorphism. So it's just some monomial map, monomial algebra homomorphism from this quantum torus to that quantum torus, basically like a change of basis in the underlying lattice. But the really interesting part of the quantum mutation is this automorphism part, which is given by conjugation by the quantum bilogarithm in the cluster variable xk, corresponding to the vertex we mutated at. Okay, using this this sort of Q difference equation satisfied by the 1 plus qx terms. So this quantum dilogarithm satisfies this Q difference equation, which you can use together with the Q commutation relation to derive sort of formulas for this quantum mutation in terms of subtraction-free, non-commutative rational functions or whatever. But somehow the conceptual way to think about it is you're really just conjugating by a dilogarithm function. Okay. So great. So now I can finally talk about what all this business has to do with quantum groups. Okay. So what I will talk about now is some joint work with Alexander Shapiro. From this year. So let me explain one of the theorems that we proved. From earlier this year. So let's write TQ for the quantum torus corresponding to the cluster chart. So let me rephrase this a bit. So let's first of all let S hat be this annulus with two mark points on the outer boundary and no mark point on the inner boundary, okay? And then we're going to fix the quantum torus corresponding to the triangulation of S hat that I'll draw for you right now. So the one we want to consider is going to be the one we drew on this left board, where we glued two pairs of triangles by two sides. So then what does the theorem say? It says that there's an algebra embedding of UQ SLN plus 1 into this quantum torus algebra. Such that for every generator xi plus or minus of the quantum group that we set it out with, there is a cluster in which xi plus or minus is a cluster monomial. OK, so that's what the theorem says. And you, what's more, you can describe this embedding in very kind of explicit terms. So how am I doing on the time front?
We got the room until
5:30. OK. Is 5:30 a, is it supposed to be 1 hour or 1 hour and a half seminar?
So I think the room's
when it's
hours
at the shoe, it's easily 1 hour and a half.
OK.
Yeah, so this is a spare room, so.
Yes.
OK.
But, so sorry, can you just ring it again? So
yeah.
That there is such an embedding for. Mm-hmm.
Such that for every Chevalier generator xi plus or minus, there's a cluster, a mutation equivalent to the one corresponding to this triangulation, in which that Chevalier generator becomes a cluster monomial.
And there's just one embedding?
I mean, there's going to be multiple clusters in which xi plus or minus is a cluster monomial.
No, I'm saying that the map from the uh-huh. QFS on plus 1 to the quantum torus, there's just one map.
Yes. There's a single map, and then you can look at it in various clusters. And in some clusters, certain Chevalier generators would be very simple, and in other ones, they will be less simple. Yeah. Right. So the way that this embedding works is kind of very simple and kind of combinatorial in flavor. So you just kind of describe it. So in SL2, so this is the quiver here that describes the situation for UQ of SL2. So let's kind of number these vertices in order to describe how this thing works. So question or just?
Not yet.
OK. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how to describe embedding of UQSL2 into the algebra described by the cyclic quiver? Well, I have to tell you where my generators x plus and x minus go. So x plus is going to go to x1. So x plus is going to kind of follow this path from one side of the quiver to the other one, going sort of up and to the right. So x1 times 1 plus q x2, close bracket. And x minus is going to be obtained just by rotating the picture 180 degrees. So it's going to go to x2 times 1 plus q x3. Oh, wait, sorry. x3 times 1 plus q x. Wait, sorry. Messed up my numbering. So if I'm following along the top, it's x1 times 1 plus q x4. If I'm going along the bottom, it's x3 times 1 plus q x2. OK? So you can kind of see the pattern in general. Let me just describe it in the case of SL3.
Would there be a triangulation where x plus and x minus are
linearly? Yeah. So if we flip, if we need, we can flip to like a self-ordered triangle, like this. It corresponds to doing the mutation at say vertex 2, and then x plus.
But you cannot flip both.
You cannot flip both. Yeah, because they don't q-commute with each other. They have this commutation relation. Yeah.
Can I ask a question? So in this case, suppose you take all cluster monomials
uh-huh.
in all clusters,
uh-huh.
and look at them as elements of UPSL 2.
Uh-huh.
So,
except this is an embedding, not a surjection.
Oh, I see. Sorry.
So really, this is something like a W fold to one cover, in the same way that the Grothendieck resolution at the level of, on the regular part is like a Galois cover. But yeah.
So
Are
there any other cluster monomials which actually come as elements?
Oh, absolutely. Or the quantum root vectors are all cluster monomials.
Oh, wait, coming to
like the PPW base.
Well, and some products of those.
Yeah.
So I'm just wondering if this has anything to do with some kind of canonical basis.
That's a good question.
Ideally, I would like to say have a following statement that that cluster monomials are elements with canonical basis.
I mean that kind of statement.
What is the right statement actually? But
yeah. So that kind of statement should be visible even on the level of a single triangle, where you're essentially working with UQ of B plus, right?
Yeah.
I mean, this is really where canonical basis should. I mean, probably this is sort of implicit in some of these works on the categorification of the cluster varieties by Geiss, Leclerc, and these guys, right? I think that's basically what they prove.
Can you very quickly go to lamination?
This I don't quite know. Maybe Ian can explain.
What would happen with...
If somebody could speak to the laminations across
bonds to these guys?
I mean, are they laminations?
I would have to think about it.
I mean,
it's not hard, but...
I'm a bit ignorant about the lamination.
It would take a moment.
Anyway, just to give like a slight flavor of how things work in SL3, let me draw the picture there. And sort of to emphasize the role of these variables on the edges as being kind of coefficient variables, let me kind of draw them as squares, sort of frozen type variables. And then when we glue up our two basic quivers by two sides, we're going to get a picture that looks something like this. And remember, when we subdivide, we have to kind of make these extra nodes the intersection points. And we also have some extra junk. Yes. Now we orient everything up. Okay, so that's how the quiver looks when I glue together two triangles by two sides, corresponding to this triangulation for SL3. And just to sort of give you a flavor of how the embedding works, let me number the nodes of the quiver in the following way. So I kind of want to think about these left-hand square vertices as being like the Dinkin diagram of SL3. And I want to kind of think about paths going from this Dinkin diagram on the left to the Dinkin diagram on the right. So the way that my x1 plus looks is going to be just like in SL2. It's going to be x1 comma 1 times 1 plus q times x1 comma 2. And then the way that x2, so we're following this path like this. And then for x2, it's going to be following a path from this top left vertex to the top right vertex. So let me index these nodes on that path by, 2 comma 1 for the first one, 2 comma 2 for the second one, 2 comma 3 for the third one, 2 comma 4 for the fourth one. And then the way that x2 plus looks like is again one of these kind of telescopic sums. So it's x2 1 times 1 plus q, x2 2 times 1 plus q times x2 3 times 1 plus q times x2, 4. Hopefully I have enough parentheses there. Anyway, but you see that all that's happening is I'm starting out from this. So if I want to build x2, I built it up by starting here and then successively mutating at vertices here, here, and here. Because every time I mutate by this difference equation for the Q dialog, I expand up another one, open up another one of these parentheses in this formula on the bottom. So you can see that if you want to go to the cluster where X2 is monomial, for instance, I just have to mutate, you know, here, here, and here, and then X2 will correspond to just this cluster monomial over here. So it's basically just following paths in this quiver.
Answer
yeah.
Debbie's question.
Ah, yeah, yeah, cool.
The lamination, so the lamination corresponding to the function. So you look at x plus, right? It's x dot. So you know that x plus in the coordinate chart corresponding to the loop, the triangulation of the loop.
Yes.
Okay, so lamination will consider will consist of like the edges that you've drawn in that diagram. Mm-hmm. So it consists of those edges with some weights like plus or minus one. And I should show them what this line does.
So like
it will only involve
the loop itself, yes, like
probably
is a lamination.
Yeah. It could it may probably involve the boundary line.
Cool, thanks. Okay, so I just want to kind of finish by, so I sort of described in some cluster algebraic or geometric terms the algebra structure of UQG, and I just want to finish by explaining the other interesting aspects of its Hopf structure, namely the coproduct and the R matrix in terms, in sort of similar terms, because the answer turns out to be quite nice. So let me first quickly say a word about the coproduct, which is very simple. So firstly, if we want to talk about the coproduct, we have to talk about the tensor square of EQG. And this fellow here is again going to be described by another quantum character variety type thing, but now corresponding to, we can have two mode points in the boundary, but now we have two holes in the interior. So this is what is going to quantize to give me the tensor square of UQG. And what's going on in terms of the combinatorics of the quivers? Well, all we're doing is we're kind of sticking two of these quivers together and then gluing by the kind of and the sort of pair of edges, if that makes sense. So for SL2, we'd take two of these cycles and just kind of amalgamate them together. Oops, it's going the wrong way. OK, so this would be UQSL2 tensor square. And the how do we describe the coproduct of E and coproduct of X plus and X minus? So remember that before we were kind of following these paths along from sort of one edge to the other edge. Now we do the same thing, but just going all the way along this kind of W or M type shape. So this would be my delta of X plus. And the one that goes in the other direction will be that delta of x minus. So the coproduct is nice and simple. But the really neat thing is how the R matrix works. Exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. So probably not terribly surprising. So yeah, I think this observation actually, like, well, maybe it goes back even further, but in the case of like the like UQSL2 and the quantum triangular theory, I think it was sort of first observed by Kashayev, but maybe even earlier. I don't know. But the point is that we have this this Dane twist, or really like sort of half of a Dane twist, rotating the two punctures. sort of around one another. And the really neat thing is that this thing can be described by a sequence of cluster transformations. So in particular, like, how do you see that it can be realized by cluster transformations? Well, the reason is that it can be realized by flips of triangulation. So let me just try and convince you that it's true, that you really can. So this is kind of like the triangulation corresponding to just gluing the two quivers together by one side. And now what we want to do is do some flips of diagonal in order to do this half Dane twist. So we'll first flip this vertical guy. Now let's flip this guy. Flip him around like that. And now we can flip this fellow here. Something like that. And now finally, we just flip this guy in here. And see, what we've done is half of a Dane twist. OK? So so that shows that this, we get automorphism of UQ tensor squared given by four flips of triangulation times n plus 2 q's 3 cluster mutations. And then what Kashayev observed for SL2 and what Sasha and I proved for SLN is that this half Dane twist automorphism coincides with the automorphism of the tensor square of UQG given by conjugation of the R matrix. Okay? And so just to conclude, you get this sort of amusing corollary, which is R factors. So we've already seen one factorization of the R matrix into a product over the simple roots. But it turns out to, because of this cluster combinatorics, to admit kind of a refined factorization into 4 times n plus 2 q's 3 quantum dilogarithms of, so the, not quantum root vectors, but something kind of simpler, something which all just sort of q commutes with itself. So quantum dilogarithms of cluster monomials. So kind of a really bizarre thing. So in the case of, just to compare with the usual factorization, say for SL2, you get the sort of Kirillov Rakitikin factorization would just have one term, it's just x plus tensor x minus. But here we're going to get like product of like 4 dilogarithms of cluster of monomials, so some sort of strange refinement of the original Kirillov-Rakitikin. So yeah, I think I'll stop there.
So this relation is probably the reason quantum dilogarithms appear in the
right, in that fact.
Logs, mm-hmm. Which is theory. Right.
Yeah,
I don't know if they're like detailed on how to get quantum dilogarithms, quantum hooks from Chan-Simons theory, which I mean, it didn't have yet irregular singularities, but it has a construction which can be interpreted in terms of irregular singularities.
Ah, interesting. So what's this paper again? It's
it's whole paper. I think the reference.
Ah, that would be fantastic. Yeah, cool. Yeah. But yeah, I would definitely like to understand better the kind of field theoretic meaning of the quantum cluster varieties. That's something I would certainly like to understand better.
So questions are people you
I have just a list of questions. So how SLN specific is all of this?
So we actually have an expert in the room on how to generalize this cluster combinatorics to the other types, right? So the extent to which it's SLN specific is the extent to which I know what to draw inside of a single triangle. Boiling down to like the Weyl group combinatorics of how to write factorization coordinates on a Borel in.
My first question would be like, is it a technical problem where, I mean, would you expect that more or less all of this should go through?
It should all go through. Yeah.
Thank us again.